From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Race politics and the NFL's culture of silence. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point. The National Football League is as American as apple pie, with deep roots in popular culture. Now, the nation's most profitable sports enterprise is caught up in race politics, with some players refusing to stand for the Star-Spangled Banner. So far, only black players have been taking the knee, but some white teammates are joining demands for racial equality. And that's not all. Players are also speaking out about long-term injury. As research shows, the longer and harder they play, the more likely is permanent brain damage. Today's talking point after Charlottesville, the ACLU sees limits to the First Amendment. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Devoted sports fans may not like it, but America's most divisive controversy has reached the National Football League. We'll hear how players are speaking out for racial equality and protection from debilitating injury. Later on today's talking point, the ACLU defended the right of Unite the Right to demonstrate in Charlottesville. Then came last weekend's deadly violence. Now, ACLU affiliates in California say free speech has its limits. First, this news update. It is official. The White House says Chief of Staff John Kelly and Steve Bannon have agreed this will be Steve's last day. Did the president's chief strategist resign, or was he fired? Here's the president talking about Bannon last Tuesday.
We'll see what happens with Mr. Bannon, but he's a good person, and I think the press treats him, frankly, very unfairly.
Kevin Robillard reports for Politico. Good to have you with us.
Great to be on.
Mr. Bannon, said the president, we don't hear that very often from him. He usually refers to his staff members by their first names.
Yeah, and it does. And that sort of speaks a little bit to how Trump actually saw, at least for a time, saw Bannon as an equal. Bannon is a fellow, very wealthy person. Trump, you know, doesn't see many of his staff members as his equals. That's pretty much limited to the other people on his staff who have made a lot of money, people like Bannon. Bannon worked at Goldman Sachs for a time, people like Gary Cohn, or to the military generals that he's also become quite fond of, people like John Kelly, the new White House chief of staff. So Bannon clearly was a person who had the president's respect, and it's not quite clear what exactly got him on outs with the president. There's been some speculation. A lot of it has to do with the fact that Bannon got so much attention and seemed to be getting credit for Trump's election victory when Trump believes the credit should go to him. There's also just some speculation that with John Kelly empowered, John Kelly was, you know, forcing out Bannon because Bannon represented sort of a rival power center in the White House. So it's not quite clear the exact cause of this departure. But it's a big shift in how the White House has operated.
Well, and just this week, Bannon did an interview with Robert Kuttner of the very liberal American Prospect, during which he utterly contradicted the president's position toward North Korea, said that there is no military solution in North Korea, talked about a harder line in China, said he had the right to hire and fire people in the State Department, named Susan Thornton, who is East Asian and Pacific Affairs acting head at State, said she was out. Did that get, you know, that got a lot of attention at the White House, one would assume.
Yeah, it did. And to be clear, there was already rumors that Bannon was on his way out before that article even appeared. And Bannon has tried to claim through different people in the media that he didn't realize he was speaking on the record, which is a bit difficult to believe considering Bannon, before joining the White House, owned a media company. So it's hard to believe he didn't quite understand the difference between on and off the record, or excuse me, ran a media company rather than owned it. But yeah, it's that clearly got a lot of attention, and it seemed to be to a lot of people in the recent days that Bannon, if he was going to go out, was sort of going to go out on its own terms. Beyond that American Prospect interview, he had also sort of sent on the record comments both to the New York Times and to the Washington Post in recent days on different issues. He seemed to be clear that he wanted his ideology to stay and know people that his ideology would still have a role in Trump's administration, even if he was going to be gone.
So what's next? He was associated, of course, with Breitbart, and that is principal among his links to the far right. Is he likely to go back there?
That's definitely a possibility. The Washington Post is reporting that Bannon met earlier this week with Robert Mercer, who is the billionaire backer both of Breitbart and of Trump's campaign. Mercer is something of Bannon's patron, in a way. So I think it's clear that Bannon will still be around. It looks likely that he'll be going back to Breitbart, but there's been no official announcement of that just yet. What position he takes at Breitbart could be very interesting once he gets back there. Obviously, he'll play a big role in the coverage, but whether they sort of go to war with the White House or go to war with what Bannon perceives as his enemies in the White House or go to war with the Republican Party writ large, all of those remain open questions as Bannon tries to push his sort of populist, right-wing, economic nationalist agenda.
He was called called chief strategist. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, and who is likely to take the job?
So that's one interesting part of this. If you ask people what exactly Steve Bannon did, people wouldn't necessarily always have an answer for you. And that was part of what John Kelly's question and problem with Bannon was. One thing John Kelly did when he took over as chief of staff was he initiated a review of what everyone's responsibilities were. And the original thought was that Bannon would sort of provide longer-term direction, and Reince Priebus, the original chief of staff, would sort of manage things day-to-day. That didn't quite work out, and it looks like basically there might not be a direct replacement for Steve Bannon because it's not necessarily a role that has to exist. The administration writ large can sort of come up with what its long-term strategy is. There doesn't necessarily need to be one person in charge of it. So I don't necessarily think that there will be anyone directly replacing Bannon.
All right. Another extraordinary situation at the Trump White House, which is now CNN showed a picture this morning of White House filled with, I think, six or eight staff members, and only two of them are left, Trump and the vice president of the United States. So there's nothing like change. Kevin Robillard, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be on.
Reporter with Politico. In a moment, race politics and the NFL's culture of silence on To The Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To The Point. Former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick is out of a job. He once helped the San Francisco 49ers reach the Super Bowl, but he's best known for refusing to stand for the Star-Spangled Banner. He said the nation isn't keeping its promise of equality for people of color. Michael Bennett is an all-star defensive end for the Seattle Seahawks. He's very much employed. In the aftermath of Saturday's deadly violence by white racists in Charlottesville, though, he says he'll refuse to stand for the national anthem this season.
I think there's a lot of players in the NFL and around the Major League Baseball and just athletes in general who are talking about these issues because we live these issues. I mean, at this point in America, I can't hide behind the shield. I can't hide behind the logo to the team I play for. I can't hide behind the brands that I play for. I'm a black man in America, and I'm living what's going on right now. And I think a lot of players agree with that. They all talk about it, and it's very hard to talk about it on the outside because you know that you're going to be judged for what you say.
Des Beeler is a sports writer for The Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Indeed. So Kaepernick is out of a job. Is this going to get Bennett fired?
Probably not. No, I don't think the NFL is going to go so far as to cut players who are currently on the team. Kaepernick was in a bit of an unusual situation in that he was sort of the leader of the anthem protest last season, but he'd actually arranged with the 49ers to restructure his contract to give himself an out clause, which he exercised in March at the beginning of free agency. I think he would likely have been released by the team, albeit possibly for on-field reasons. They changed their coaching staff. I think they were looking to go in a different direction anyway. But he essentially turned himself into a free agent And so it's more a matter of the NFL not actively giving him a job. Bennett is in the first year, I think, of a three-year, $30 million or so contract extension. He's, in relative terms, I think, a better player than Kaepernick, although Kaepernick plays a more important position. So I think Bennett is enjoying pretty good job security for the time being.
So what about other players? And is there going to be, do you think, a movement in the NFL led now by Bennett?
Right. I mean, I think Bennett is very consciously taking on the mantle of the sort of leader of this movement, if that's how you want to put it, I mean, in Kaepernick's absence. And he's always been an outspoken guy. He has a brother named Martellus Bennett who plays tight end for the Packers, who's also equally outspoken. And both of them are very sort of socially aware people, very sort of intellectual people. And so I think, you know, this isn't something that sort of is new to him or is uncomfortable for him. In fact, he's writing a book. I believe the title is called Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. I believe that's sort of a tongue-in-cheek sort of title, and I think he wants it to have some humor in it. But he's obviously someone who's very interested in pursuing these sorts of topics. And, you know, it really does remain to be seen how much this spreads in the NFL. We just had our second round of preseason games on Thursday. One player raised his fist during the anthem. That was Malcolm Jenkins for the Eagles, who had been doing that last season and continued it last week in the first playoff game. And he'd said he was going to continue his anthem protests. And what was very interesting about what happened last night was that a white teammate named Chris Long put his arm around Jenkins. So he didn't raise his own fist. He certainly didn't kneel, but he made an obvious show of support for his teammate Jenkins. And that was something that Michael Bennett had actually called for just a day or two before. He'd said, you know, people like me can make these protests, but what's really going to change the conversation is if white players get involved. And he didn't specify Chris Long, but Long was a pretty likely candidate to do something like this because he's also exhibited a lot of social awareness through his Twitter feed and on other platforms. And he's also from Charlottesville. He was raised in Charlottesville. He played at UVA. I think he has a home there. So he was very affected by what happened there and I think very disappointed by the presidential administration's response to it.
And here is Chris Long explaining why he did what he did.
We need to come together. You know, and if anybody really has an issue with somebody being an ally, if somebody's fighting for equality in a week like this against white supremacy, I think that's sad. I don't think the president's done a good enough job of striking it down. I share that sentiment with a lot of people, but with or without the president's reaction, I think this is something as Americans, the reason I stand for the anthem is because I'm standing for Americans and what we can be.
Let me introduce Ben Domenech. He's a conservative writer, television commentator, a publisher of the website called The Federalist. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
You have written, essentially, that the National Football League is no place for politics. Do you still feel that way, given what we've heard from these players?
I think that there's a separation that needs to occur between politics and sports, and I'll tell you why. The fact is that when these players are showing these displays of speaking to our politics, they're doing it actually on the field. They're doing it during the course of a game, as opposed to away from the field. You heard Chris Long there obviously giving an interview that I think is perfectly fine. But one of the things that I think is very valuable about sports, that it has an impact on our community, is the ability for people of all races and creeds who have very different politics and very different beliefs about the world to stand in a stadium together, to wear the hat or the gear of the same team, and become united through that process. I think that's something that's very valuable socially, especially at a time when things are so tribal and the fabric of the nation is frayed in so many different ways. For us to come together and to have sports be a place of real affirmation for each other as Americans and for the strength of a community. I, of course, don't object to anything that Chris Long was just saying there. I just think that when these displays start to run into the arena of games, I think that we lose something along the way that's important about that aspect that sports plays in our society.
But what I understand the players to be saying is that America is not giving them what it has promised them, and consequently they can't affirm it in the way that you suggest.
I think that they obviously have their own political beliefs and points, and I think that it's totally fine for, you know, members of you know, any industry to express themselves. But I think that sports, the value that sports has together is something that doesn't deserve to be politicized and ought not be politicized for any particular thing. If these players were saying that they were standing up that they were, you know, kneeling or doing some other kind of display because of their belief in gun rights or because of their beliefs about trans bathroom issues or something like that, I think that if this was, you know, if this was reaching that level where all these different players were doing that, that it would detract from the value that sports has as being one of the few areas in public life today where you can see people of all backgrounds and all races come together to affirm something.
Jess Beeler, let me go back to you, sports writer for the Washington Post. How do you respond to that, and what's the view of the owners who are mostly conservative white business people, one of whom is going to be ambassador to the United Kingdom?
Right. Yeah, that would be Woody Johnson, owner of the Jets and a major Republican fundraiser. And the Jets have certainly been identified as a team that, sure, it certainly seems like could use a player of Kaepernick's talents. I mean, they appear to be going into the season with one of the worst depth charts at quarterback the NFL has ever seen. And they, in the offseason, they added a player named Josh McCown, who's 37 or 38 and has always been a journeyman, always been sort of a backup player in the NFL, and has nowhere near the resume of Kaepernick, who, you know, has struggled to some degree in the past couple of years, but went to a Super Bowl 3 years ago and went to an NFC championship the year before that, and, you know, really has accomplished quite a bit during his career. You know, I think that the owners, they haven't said a lot about it overtly. There have been a couple of instances where some public statements were made, such as by John Mara, the owner of the Giants. He said the most forceful thing about the Kaepernick situation specifically, saying that, you know, he'd never gotten such an outpouring from fans saying, don't sign this guy. We don't want you. We don't want you to sign him. We don't like what he did. We're really opposed to this. He said, you know, and you have to remember, NFL teams sign players who may have done things that get on fans' nerves or that outrage people. I mean, we're talking about domestic violence, you know, all sorts of possible incidents of malfeasance, and yet that doesn't seem to be quite as much. That doesn't seem to bring out quite the vitriol that the Kaepernick case has. And when the Ravens lost their starting quarterback Joe Flacco during training camp, I think a lot of people thought, okay, well, now's the time to bring in Kaepernick. He was passed over during free agency. Maybe teams didn't want to say, we actively want to sign this player. But once an injury arrives, then I think there was some thought that maybe that would give cover to teams to say, okay, now we're kind of up against it. You know, we have to bring in a good player. We've suffered an injury at our most important position. And the Ravens made a very big show of deliberating over the issue and asking fans, asking former players. And the owner, it essentially came down to the owner, Steve Bisciotti, just saying, apparently just being uncomfortable with the idea. He as much as said, I don't really like what Kaepernick did. And at the end of the day, they didn't sign him, even though, you know, their own backup quarterback, Ryan Mallett, doesn't appear to be any kind of great NFL talent. So, you know, I think you can sort of discern that ownership in general is opposed to what Kaepernick did. And I think the biggest thing you can discern is that they are afraid of a fan backlash. You know, I think they've made the calculation that Kaepernick isn't such a good player that you have to have him, you know, that the benefit of having him on your team is worth the cost of aggravating so much, or at least in their perception, so much of your fan base.
So, Ben Domenech, aren't the owners then and the managers of the teams being just as political as the players? Can you expect one to step down if the other doesn't?
I think that the fans here is really the core of what's going on. It's the fan outrage at Kaepernick. Otherwise, he would be on a team because he is not he's not a great quarterback by any means, but he's not the 33rd, you know, worst quarterback in the league. He would be on a team if he was not attracting the kind of fan backlash to his behavior. But I think that the truth is there have been a lot of players who've gone out and said supportive things about Black Lives Matter. They've said, several things that have been critical over the course of recent years concerning cop killings and the like. They've expressed their views on social media, and this is something that you see across sports. You certainly see it among a number of prominent NBA players. I think the difference is that does not offend people to the degree that refusing to stand for the anthem in context at a game does. They view that as something that's unpatriotic, that is maybe anti-cop or anti-military, and they don't like that infecting the issue of sports past. They also, frankly, don't like hearing about these issues within sports media. There's been a rampant amount of criticism, particularly directed at ESPN, over the issue of making their broadcast too politicized from the perspective of some fans. And I think that this is another aspect that this takes on when they turn away from the kind of fractiousness that you see in our political coverage today to the channel that they want to just hear about their players or hear about their teams. They don't like these stories creeping into them, and there's been this backlash, as the reporter's been saying. This is something where I think the owners, if they thought Kaepernick could help them win without getting that kind of fan backlash, they would have given him a job.
Des Beeler, back to you. What do you think, again, sports writer for the Washington Post, what do you think about the argument that sports writers, and particularly those people on ESPN who are broadcasting games, ought to stay out of the politics?
Well, I mean, perhaps on the while delivering SportsCenter, maybe. I mean, I don't know if he's talking about the coverage of it. And I think there are, you know, I've written quite a bit about Kaepernick and Michael Bennett and all these a lot of sort of related issues. And you know, one reason we write about it so much is because there's a lot of interest in it. You know, those stories get a lot of interest. People find these issues pretty compelling, at least among our readership. So I don't think you're going to see coverage of it drop off out of some sense that really. The only thing sports writers, I mean, it's almost like the ultimate expression of stick to sports, right? I mean, even sports writers should only write about the actual on-field events and not all the other stuff that happens. I mean, I just don't think that's unrealistic. That's realistic. You know, and I think the cat's out of the bag a little bit as far as athletes expressing their social awareness. And I think they are getting more politicized in the era of Trump. And you know, if you think about something like standing for the anthem, I mean, the football players, they're paid to play football. That's why they got contracts. You know, you're asking them to engage in a ceremony that isn't really directly related to what they're there for. And we can, you know, that's a separate discussion of whether we should play the anthem before games or not. But, you know, at that point, they are being asked to do something that's kind of unusual for the workplace. So to say that they're bringing their politics into the workplace, well, I mean, most of our workplaces, we don't start by standing for the national anthem. And, yeah, but- you know, I wonder what would happen if... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we have a very few seconds left before we go to a break, and I just want to introduce a third guest, who's Bill Roden, longtime sports journalist, now writing for ESPN's The Undefeated. He's author of the book $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. Good to have you on our program.
Hi there. Nice to meet you.
As I say, I'm sorry to say we have a short time before we go to a break, but we'll come back to you after that. But what's your take on the idea that this is not something that has a place in sports, that people ought to sit back and have a beer and watch the game?
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that stopped in 1947 with Jackie Robinson. So that horse left the barn a long time ago. And also, I think, you know, as my colleague at the Washington Post said, you know, I think playing of the national anthem is ridiculous. I mean, you politicize the event as soon as you play that. You know, I mean, it's you don't play that in anything else. I mean, I've been at jazz concerts, and you don't start the concert off by playing the national anthem. I think you politicize an event the moment you play the national anthem. And then you've got jets flying overhead. At Yankee Stadium, I mean, some stadiums go even further. Now they play God Bless America, and the announcer says, stand up, take off your hats. You know, and so you are basically politicizing event, and you are putting thoughtful people like athletes in a position of, do I really, really want to stand for this? I mean, this is not, you know, this is not something I really agree with. So I think that, number one, if there was no national anthem, then Kaepernick would, you know, you don't. But when you put that red cape in front of the bull, you are inciting problems.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a break, as I said, on our talking point later on. After Charlottesville, the ACLU is seeing limits to the First Amendment. We'll talk about that. We'll continue this conversation after just a moment. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, we're not only back, but to the point. Does politics belong in sports? We're talking about the players in the National Football League who are refusing to stand for the Star-Spangled Banner. Bill Roden, who's longtime with ESPN, says that we politicize the sports themselves, all the sports, but particularly, of course, we're talking about football, when we play the national anthem. Ben Domenech, back to you with the Federalist. What do you say to that?
Well, I would just suggest that I think most Americans would disagree with it. That's politicization. I think they believe that it's an expression of patriotic unity. And I think a lot of people, you know, have experienced over the last several years, you know, as these increasingly tribal animosities between different people have increased, they may have, you know, had issues with being able to do that kind of expression of national unity. But I certainly think that, you know, when you say the Pledge of Allegiance, when you sing God Bless America, and when you sing the Star Spangled Banner at the beginning of a baseball game or something like that, I think that's a good thing to do together, to see people who come from very different backgrounds singing together about the nation that we all love and want to see succeed. And maybe he feels that's too much of a political statement, but from my perspective, it's something that is simply patriotic. And I would say that, you know, I would be critical of any ball player, of any football or baseball player who during President Obama's presidency said that they weren't going to sing or weren't going to stand for the national anthem because they didn't like his policies or because they didn't think that he was someone who should be in that office. And I would criticize anybody who would do the same under this president as well.
So, Bill Roden, what do you say to that? The nation is so divided in so many ways, and Ben Domenech is not alone in saying that at least with sports we have a chance to come together and all be in favor of something, namely the team we're rooting for.
Well, that's a myth. I mean, when you say all Americans all Americans like who? You know, it's like you take these polls of people, and you go, well, like who? A lot of my friends aren't necessarily patriotic in the way I think, you know, that you feel there's patriotism. I can't look at things in Charlotte, or I can't look at things in Ferguson. I can't look, you know, and say, I look at this. This country has serious, serious, serious unresolved problems. And by the way, almost 90% of the fans watching this are white. You know, so it's not like you had this whole sea of this integration of fans, and so everybody's sort of on the same page. Most of the fans at these NFL games, NBA games, Major League Baseball games are white. And trust me, even within that group, there's a diversity of thought. You know, so I think that this idea, of course, is politicized. And if you get into a deep dive into the national anthem, I mean, Francis Scott Key, there's a verse there that almost suggests that Francis Scott Key is favoring slavery. You know, so, I mean, I just think that when you put that anthem there, it politicizes it. And this finally, I think that Michael Bennett said something earlier. There are a whole lot of players who agree with him, but they're afraid. They're fierce. Jerry Jones has hinted that if any of his players demonstrate razor fist, he's going to cut them. Well, we know that's not true because if his entire defensive unit decides to protest, he's not cutting anybody. So I just think that, number one, if you don't want to politicize the event, you know, don't play the national anthem. And this whole idea of patriotism, what it is, you know, what it is for you means something completely different for me. So, you know, it's just complex. Just like on the plantation, you had the slave owner next to a slave both praying to God, but they were probably praying for two different things, you know. So that is the deep dilemma, unresolved dilemma of this country, and it continues to play out. It continues to play out. The president is fueling that in a way that Obama never did. I mean, you can't say that. You can't compare Obama with this guy. You can't. This guy deals with divisive politics. He fuels racism. Obama never did that except by simply being black.
Okay.
You know, so.
Let me go back to Ben Domenech quickly because we want to go to the issue of head injuries, which is part of our program as well. But what do you say to that? That this is an opportunity for people who aren't being heard to speak to a largely white audience, or whether the audience wants to hear it or not.
Well, I've grown up as a fan of a lot of DC area teams, and I can tell you that the audience there is fairly diverse. The thing that I think that you are saying about the politicization of the anthem and what that means, I just don't think you would have to stop there. You would have to bring the flags down. You would have to get rid of these patriotic sentiments that, you know, are all over the place at sporting events. And I think that that's something that we should avoid, because we do want to have at least one aspect of national unity in a time of such anger and strife. I remember playing when they started playing baseball after 9/11, how valuable that was for bringing the country together after a terrible tragedy. And I think that sports, time and again, provides enormous healing power to communities in the wake of terrible tragedies and attack. And I think that that's something valuable that we shouldn't lose. Certainly, these guys can express their opinions. They have massive social media followings. They have a massive stature within communities to be able to be heard when they go on TV, when they do interviews, when they do all these things, and they are free, of course, to express themselves. I just think that sports has enormous power to heal and to provide a place of unity, and that I'm begging you to consider that in the context of this broader conversation that we're going to continue to have about politics.
Let me introduce Jim Joyce. He's a former Denver Broncos defensive end. He's now CEO of Athlon. That's a medical company doing research on brain injuries. Jim Joyce, great to have you, and thanks for being with us.
Nice to be on the show today.
As a former player, rather than as the president of your company, we'll talk about that in a moment, what's your take on the argument that we're having?
Well, I think I'm very much on the side of Ben's viewpoint. I mean, it's my viewpoint that players are paid quite well to be part of a team whose focus is primarily to win football games. And I can't help but believe that individual political actions, you know, are both disruptive and disrespectful to teammates.
Okay. What about the racial aspect of it and the statement by Bill Roden that black athletes simply don't feel that they're getting the kind of equal treatment that is promised by the nation and what it's supposed to stand for?
Yeah, I don't disagree with Bill, but I just don't think in the context of a football game, that it's the right environment or the right platform.
Okay. Let us leave it at that for the moment, and let me ask you about the research that's being done on brain injuries, because there's been a lot of publicity on it, including a report that when the brains of football players were autopsied after their deaths, it was found that a great many of them were suffering from long-term injuries, and that turns out to be true in terms of those who managed to live to an older age as well. What can you tell us about it?
Well, you're talking about the latest publication in JAMA from the Boston University group, who has diagnosed CTE at autopsy in 110 of 111 former NFL players.
What is CPE?
It stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and it's a neurological disorder. It's one of 21 different disorders known as tauopathies that involve the abnormal plaquing of tau protein in the brain. Included amongst those diseases is also Alzheimer's disease.
What does this tell us about football and the nature of the game and the way it's played?
Well, it's... First off, when you look at the history of the NFL's role in dismissing CTE as a disease or as a condition that's prevalent in NFL players, it makes them look suspect. However, you know, this disease is becoming discovered in a wide range of sports that seem to involve repetitive head trauma. But the reality is it's a very newly defined disease. And there's still very much we don't know about the disease. We don't know the mechanisms that underlie the pathology of the disease. We don't really have clarity if it's caused primarily by concussions or if it's repetitive subconcussive blows. We don't know the role of other disease conditions in causing this disease. And in fact, we don't know that it's not an evolutionary mechanism that's a protective mechanism in individuals that suffer from these issues. So we're seeing it diagnosed very prevalently. We don't know the incidence in the normal population. We are seeing the incidence in individuals that are tested in autopsy and other sports like BMX riding, hockey, soccer. There does seem to be a high incidence in other disease conditions as well.
more attention paid to the NFL than others, partly because more people watch it, I presume, and also because the instances of head bashing are so dramatic and so much a part of the game. Have the owners been, you said that they initially dismissed the CTE as not even being a disease. Have they come around at all? And what have they had to say to players who, while they're still on teams, object to what's going on or want to know more research and are concerned about it?
Well, there needs to be more research. Right now, the research is concentrated primarily at Boston University. I think it would benefit the NFL to expand to help initiate research at other institutes. I mentioned earlier that CTE is a form of a tauopathy, much like Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's was discovered in 1906, and there's been tens of thousands of researchers and billions of dollars spent to try to unravel this disease condition to what we know today. At present, there's just a handful of researchers studying CTE. So it's while we're seeing the high prevalence at autopsy, we're not really sure what it means. And so as it reflects back to NFL owners, they themselves are blind to what this means because the research community hasn't been able to connect the dots yet.
Bill Roden, back to you with ESPN. Do the owners have an obligation to look further and to finance further the research into CTE?
No, absolutely. And I think he makes a lot of really great points about the magnitude of this. I don't think that this is really just a football issue. It's become people's, oh, this is a football issue. Well, I think, as he said, I think this is a soccer issue. This is clearly a soccer issue. It's clearly a hockey issue. I think that in terms of media, I think because the NFL has the deepest pockets and because it's the sort of national pastime, that's where you make your reputation upon, week after week, showing this guy or that. But it's a much broader thing than that. But I do think that the owner, I think, as he said, part of the problem was the sort of initial dishonesty about this, sort of the way the tobacco company eventually had to sort of have its come to Jesus moment, and they finally had to admit in court. The NFL has not come anywhere near that. I think they have an obligation not only to fund the resource, but the research, but also to make sure that players who, when they finish their career, are taken care of. It could be in the way of homes or housing or something. I think that between the owners and the Players Association, I think that they really have to look closer at how do you take care of players at the back end. I do think that they have an obligation, definitely.
Let me go back to Des Beeler again, sports writer for The Washington Post. Are more players beginning to be sensitive to this? There certainly was a time when if you went off the field injured, you got a lot of heat from your teammates because they thought you ought to grin and bear it and go back into the game.
Yeah, I think it's causing a lot of ripples in the NFL. The most recent study and the one prior to that, which I think was something like 93 of 94 brains of NFL players, it was, the numbers are really sort of overwhelming. And even if you could say that's sort of a self-selecting group and, it's not the most clinically rigorous study, I think those numbers are jarring to a lot of NFL players. I would say mostly the players who are thinking about it, are the ones who are either coming toward the end of their careers and they're starting to think about what they're going to do after football and how their lives are going to unfold, and players who've recently retired and maybe are in their early 40s. A couple of recent examples include Warren Sapp, who's in the Hall of Fame, who said he was going to donate his brain to science, and Terrell Davis, a former running back who just entered the Hall of Fame, and said, they both expressed a lot of concern about are they going down that road? Are they succumbing to CTE? They'll say things like, every time I walk in a room and I forget why I was in there, every time I drop my car keys, every time I can't remember a phone number, every time I trip over something, they're starting to get a little freaked out. They're wondering, wait, is this the onset of CTE? Am I going to get this disease that apparently is so horrific? It caused somebody like Junior Seau, another Hall of Famer who had a great family, appeared to have everything going for him, to take his own life. And Dave Duerson and other players have done it as well because of the effects, including depression, including anger, including all these mood disorders and dementia, memory loss. There are a host of really painful symptoms that come along with it. And I think players are pretty worried about that. Ben Roethlisberger, who's still playing, but has talked about maybe this will be my final season in the NFL, and he specifically cited the recent study as saying, it's among the scary things you hear about when you're playing this sport. I think players, when they're younger, they're like everyone else who's younger. You don't think about the future that much. You're in your 20s. You're full of vim and vigor. Life is endless. You're just, and they want to make money in the sport. They know that the thing that they can hang their hat on to help their families, to help themselves, is playing football.
Okay.
So I think it mostly affects players either coming to the end of their careers or who've recently retired.
So Ben Domenech, again, with the Federalist, is this something that it makes sense for players to speak out about? Should the owners in the National Football League be more sensitive to this and do more to find out what, in fact, their players are actually going through?
Absolutely, Warren. I think they absolutely should. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing, just generally across society, in addition to what we see happening within the world of sports, is the need for new research into all manner of brain diseases. As we see lifespans continue to get longer and medical science has allowed us to live much longer lives, we see the onset of these diseases to a much greater degree, not just in sports, but across the population.
Okay, and quickly, Jim Joyce, back to you. You were with the Denver Broncos, and I take it now with Ethylon, the medical company that you run, that you were inspired to do this because someone you knew well died as a result of CTE.
Sure. A former high school teammate of mine and college teammate of mine at the University of Maryland, Tom McHale, he became the second person diagnosed with CTE by the Boston University group. And this was this autopsy was presented at the Super Bowl in 2009. And we started collaborating with the BU group to look for a biomarker that could identify this disease in the living. And most recently worked with the Boston University team to publish a manuscript that identified that a biomarker our researchers discovered very much seemed to correlate with cognitive decline. This is a marker that's in the circulatory system. Correlated with cognitive decline, the worse people performed on these tests, the higher the levels of this biomarker. And in general, the marker was 9 times higher on average in NFL subjects as compared to the same age control group subjects who were athletes that participated in sports that didn't involve head trauma.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's simply all the time we have, but we do agree, I think our panel does, on that one, even if they don't, with regard to the injection of politics into the National Football League. It's great to have you all. Jim Joyce, again, CEO of Athlon, formerly with the Denver Broncos. Bill Roden with ESPN, his book, $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. Ben Domenech, conservative writer, television commentator, publisher of The Federalist, and Des Beeler with The Washington Post. Thank you all very much for being on our program. After Charlottesville, the ACLU takes another look at free speech and violence in a moment on To the Point from Public Radio International. Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. In 1934, Jewish lawyers with the American Civil Liberties Union famously defended the free speech of Nazis in the United States. In 1978, the ACLU supported a Nazi march in Skokie, Illinois, even though it was home to many Holocaust survivors. Last week's Unite the Right demonstration in Charlottesville took place after the ACLU defended the right of its organizers to a permit when authorities tried to deny it. In the aftermath, California affiliates of the ACLU are saying white supremacist violence is not free speech. Matt Pierce reports for the LA Times. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Is there a major change going on in the ACLU?
It's complicated. So basically what has happened is these three California affiliates of the ACLU have said they're going to be taking a skeptical approach to white supremacist groups that want to hold rallies like this in the future. They saw what happened in Charlottesville, didn't like what they saw, didn't think that it particularly comported to the First Amendment values that they have, dedicated their careers to defending. And they're saying, look, we obviously don't agree with their viewpoints, but we also do not have an interest in defending violent action that might come along with these rallies. So following that, the National ACLU has followed suit and agreed and said that they're going to be taking a skeptical look at rallies like this in the future. And they've also said that they're not going to defend white supremacist groups that want to come to rallies with guns.
You mentioned these three affiliates of the ACLU in California. It's a place where there have been rallies and where, in fact, we heard recently on our program that Berkeley, where there was a demonstration, was in fact a sort of a practice for what happened in Charlottesville. Is the ACLU going to look at plans for more rallies in Berkeley and other places in California very skeptically, as you say?
I think that's entirely true. They see all these public demonstrations, not just for white nationalists, but for other groups too. They look at these, and sometimes officials want to try to move them around or not permit people to march around. And so in cases like that in the past, the ACLU might accept clients who want to sue a certain city or a certain government to allow them to assemble peacefully. And this is what the ACLU has always done. They have a reputation for defending groups on the far left and the far right in court to allow them to gather. But I think one of the arguments that one of the ACLU members out here in California gave me is that the context has changed. These aren't guys who are just marching around with placards, peacefully gathering, in public parks. You look at what happened in Charlottesville, you look at what happened in Berkeley. People came with weapons, with shields, with helmets. Some people came with guns. Their argument is that it's not that their own values towards speech have changed, but that the context of these groups have changed. They've come prepared for violence, potentially against leftists and anti-fascists who have also come prepared for violence and who are ready to fight. And they're saying that this is not what they're interested in defending.
So in the past, then, they have said and upheld the idea that I may hate what you say, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it. Now they're talking about how you say it and what is free speech and what isn't.
Yeah, because violence is not free speech. I mean, this is something, to a certain extent, they're not saying anything new legally, right? We have all sorts of protections under the First Amendment. In very global terms, the First Amendment's very radical. It gives us freedoms that don't exist in a lot of other countries. You can burn the flag legally. That's protected speech. Some hate speech is protected speech. The Constitution, there have been constitutional cases that have gone up to the Supreme Court and become seminal cases. There are, the rule for violence is, if you're inciting a crowd, it has to be, an imminent, probable action of violence that would follow from your speech. So there are all sorts of protections that the First Amendment has given us, and they're saying that they think some of the stuff that we're seeing when we look at TV, and we see these guys barreling through a crowd of protesters with shields, and when we see them beating on each other with sticks, that those are crimes. That's not free speech. The law is already clear on this. But what has changed is that the ACLU does not want to facilitate events like that could happen in the future. And so they have to now, kind of go through these upcoming events with the fine tooth comb if their organizers want help from the ACLU. And they have to say, look, we saw what happened in Charlottesville. We've seen what's happened in Berkeley. What kind of assurances are we going to have that this sort of violence won't happen again? And I'm not sure. This is sort of the fuzzy part. Like, what if these organizers want to hold a peaceful rally in the future? Like, how are they going to be able to demonstrate to these ACLU affiliates that they have a viable free speech claim, that there's not going to be violence that follows from these events? And I suspect that it's going to be much more difficult for these organizers to petition the ACLU to help them in the future.
Hard for the ACLU to set a new standard, but are they saying that they in some way facilitated what happened in Charlottesville?
It's a little fuzzy. The local ACLU affiliate in Virginia is said that they're not responsible for the violence. But, there are kind of some dissenting viewpoints. There was a ACLU of Virginia board member who resigned from the group after Charlottesville, and he tweeted, the best time for ACLU to agree with me that violent Nazis don't deserve First Amendment representation was 10 days ago. The second best time is now. So there are these internal tensions in the organization about you know, protecting these viewpoints, because there's always been tensions inside the ACLU over to what extent they should protect the Ku Klux Klan and groups like the neo-Nazis. And for the most part, they've done that over the years, but it's also, you know, it's sort of what they're most famous for, but it's also what's most controversial about them, you know, among their generally left-leaning supporters. So I think to a certain extent, you see some of that internal debate happening again now. And you know, it's very important to note that, you know, the executive director of the ACLU, Anthony Romero, is saying, you know, it's not that they're not going to represent any, you know, white nationalists in the future. It's just that they're going to be a little bit more careful in examining what kind of cases they want to take.
Very quickly, you have written about what happened in Skokie, Illinois, and that another civil liberties organization, the National Lawyers Guild, accused the ACLU of poisonous even-handedness by supporting the Nazis. Is that what the ACLU is admitting to at this point?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think they're arguing that these groups were uniquely violent in Charlottesville. You know, if there was another, you know, white nationalist rally where no one came with weapons, you know, if it was a peaceful demonstration, then the ACLU would probably look at that and say, you know, we find those viewpoints repugnant. And, they've always had that stance, but they would stand up for that sort of speech, which is clearly constitutional under the First Amendment.
All right, Matt Pearce, some tough issues facing now the ACLU and those who want representation. Matt Pearce, again, a national reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
To the Point was produced this week by Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan Orr, Luke Vanderploeg, Devin Schwartz, and Gideon Brower. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Our managing producer is Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live. Podcast is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.